The Bible and Modern Science with your host, Dr. Joseph Henson of the Science Faculty of Bob Jones University. Here is Dr. Henson.
It's the flatworms for some programs. I require of my students that when we finish up a particular taxon, the taxon is simply a word that describes some category of organisms, that among other things they have in mind something that makes that unique, something that would separate that particular organism from the rest of. And we talked on our last program a little bit about the turbellarians, the planarians. Probably the most unique characteristic they have, the unique characteristic, I don't think there can be a comparative for unique, but at any rate, it is a structure that's known as a flame cell. These are the cells that act as the excretory organs. Now, we've talked several times about what is necessary from a genetic standpoint in order to have some new structure appear in the organism. And I don't want to waste time here unnecessarily, but there probably are folks that pop in and out as listeners and may or may not have heard all of this. How do you go from an organism that has no flame cell, no organ capable of serving as an organ of excretion, to one which has that? And a couple of programs ago, we talked about the idea there really is nothing in nature. There is no natural phenomenon or phenomena collectively that would somehow cause an organism without such a structure as the flame cells to form it. And there certainly is nothing within the organism itself internally that is going to cause that, some kind of a recognition of a need or some kind of wishful thinking that actually is going to bring about changes in genetic material. So you have here an interesting organism, one, in my opinion, which God created, and he created into these organisms these structures, which are very different from anything that we've talked about before. Now, we'll see in some of the other organisms in the phylum, in the flukes, and the tapeworms, not all those have that structure, and they're very different. Could there have been some kind of a common ancestor between planaria and flukes and tapeworms? Now, there are several structures, several characteristics that are common between planarians and flukes, but there are also some things that are very, very different, things that involve immensely critical differences in the kind of lifestyle that exist. And so I would like particularly creationists to keep in mind this notion that the evolutionist really has no satisfactory way of linking organisms in this phylum, linking planarians and flukes and tapeworms. And if they attempt to do that, it is simply a matter of a mental construct some way, not because such organisms actually exist. Now, I think I mentioned earlier to you that this group, the trematoda, are immensely important from the standpoint of being parasites. The classification of this group is a little uncertain. I am still tempted in my mind, the one that I learned back in graduate school, it's certainly a lot simpler, and I'm not sure that it's at all inaccurate, although for reasons I'm not sure I want to spend time with you talking about, there have been a variety of attempts to change the classification. But at any rate, those organisms that are known collectively as flukes belong here. Now, one of the more interesting of the changes of lifestyle to me is the fact that the flukes, they are parasitic, but the thing that makes them very interesting is that they will have a number of hosts. In extreme cases, there are some of the flukes that will have up to 5 or 6 alternate hosts. Often, one of the initial hosts is going to be a mollusk of some kind, maybe a snail. Then it'll be something else. Often, the final host will be a mammal, including humans. Now, without having a great deal of knowledge of biology, you can certainly imagine the difficulties that are going to face an organism that lives for a while as a an organism inside a snail's body, for example. Those structures and those abilities which are necessary for survival there are going to be very different from the characteristics and the structures that will be necessary for survival in a different host. How do these kinds of things evolve? Do we have a little organism that finds itself somehow living in a snail and decides, boy, it'd really be great if I had some kind of a change of structure and physiology and genetics that would allow me to live in a fish and then stay in the fish for a while and then somehow have changes of structure and characteristics that would allow me to exist in a vertebrate, a human being. Now, from the standpoint of evolution, these kinds of things are absolutely farcical. There is no possible way in which there can be any sensible, reasonable basis for an organism either to make these changes itself, nor are there going to be any phenomena that would cause that to occur. And what is of consequence here, that's not something that's a trial and error. It's not a back to the drawing board kind of thing. They are changes of environment which demand, if not instant, at least very rapid ability to deal with a whole different kind of environment. Now, some of these things are transported in different ways by different organisms. This whole subject of parasitology is one of my favorites in biology. But the more you study it, the more difficulties you become aware of that simply have no way of being answered from the standpoint of evolution. How about creations? What answer do we give? We have some difficulties about this. If you will recall, the God statement as he looked around at the last verse in Genesis 1 describes God as he looked at the creation he had made, and his statement about it was very good. Now, can you describe a parasite in a snail or a fish or a human being, for that matter, as being good? Well, there are a great many fundamentalists, Bible believers, creationists, who would say, well, that's not possible. You can't look at an organism that is host to another organism as being good. Now, I'm afraid I don't feel as strongly about that as some do. The point being, some say, well, since that was the case, then these parasites really never existed. They weren't in existence. There weren't any animals at the end of Genesis 1 that actually had parasites, so there has to be a whole different basis for coming up with them. I wonder if these kinds of changes may not have been changes that occurred as a result of man's sin and accompanied other changes that the Scripture tells us about. For example, the Scripture tells us that flowers had thorns on them after the effects that God chose to bring into existence on the earth as a result of Adam and Eve's sin. Now, could a parasite have been caused at the same time? It would seem to me that this is a possibility. As to how reasonable, I'm sure there'd be a great difference of opinion. But it is the problems are certainly less than the problems for the evolutionist who are trying to have totally different body shapes and structures and all the rest of it that are capable of existing in different kinds of organisms. Now, it should be apparent that the genetic instruction for a parasite is very, very complicated. The parasite can't change genetic material when it goes from one host to another. So that the genetic complement of the mature parasite, fluke in this case, the genetic makeup of the mature fluke is going to have to contain the sections of the genetic material that bring about the changes of structure as that organism goes from one host parasite relationship to another. I really don't think there's a better answer for that for creationists. It is apparent that that has to be the case. Now, some would say, why in the world did God make them like that? How come God made these organisms so they're going to move from one to another host, in some cases up to five or six? Well, you're going to have to take that up with God sometime if you have the opportunity. He, I believe, had a reason for it, and it is not always apparent to us what that reason might have been. So, as creationists, we are put in a position here of having no certain knowledge about when or why those things occurred or came into existence. But we will simply have to try and come up with an answer that is reasonable based on what we know of Scripture. And the fact is, the Scripture doesn't say anything about this. So we're left to our own devices to some degree. Does it bother me to think that prior to Adam and Eve's sin, that there were organisms that had other organisms living in them? It really doesn't, as opposed to some of my fellow creationists. There are problems with it, but I'm not in a position to say, well, no, that never happened. So this is one of those areas that we simply have to admit that we are ignorant about, and simply stick with the things that we can observe as we study these organisms in nature. So the question of parasitism, while there are no cut and dried answers for a creationist, the difficulties that we face are much less than the difficulties of the evolutionist, who is trying to provide some kind of a basis for unbelievably complicated, widespread structural and biochemical differences as these organisms go from one host to another. And there are certainly the things that are required have no basis in anything in nature that we can perceive that will give us answers about how they might have evolved. So while there are problems for both a creationist and an evolutionist, it seems to me that the evolutionist difficulties are much less serious than those of the evolutionist would be. I'm certain that there would be disagreement about that. But in any case, we certainly have the capability of observing structures and organisms and all the rest of this as we observe movement of these parasites from one host to another. And while there will not be general agreement about the answer to this, again, it is my opinion that the creationist arguments are more reasonable than the evolutionist arguments would be.
Thank you, Dr. Henson. You may send email to Dr. Henson at jhenson@bju.edu. That's jhenson@bju.edu. Or write to Dr. Joseph L. Henson, Box 34621, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, zip code 29614, in the United States of America. You're invited to listen next time for The Bible and Modern Science.